It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. This week's show, I'm going to be coming to you via a portable recorder in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. A group of three friends and I got together and decided to do a backpacking trip in the park, which is an incredible area of mountains on the east side of Alaska, which includes just very high peaks and just extremely remote areas, lots of glaciers, lots of above tree line hiking, one of the most amazing wilderness areas in the world. And so what we're doing is heading out there by bush plane to land in a remote mountain valley and spend a few days camping and hiking and just enjoying the wilderness. So that's what the show is for today. I'm already out in the park now, but our plan was to come out here starting on a Thursday and flying back on a Monday. And we began in Anchorage by having dinner at my house, planning out the trip. The four of us on the trip were all sort of middle-aged people who've got a lot of experience backpacking, so everybody had their own gear, planning out meals and all the stuff we were going to bring. That was on a Monday. Then on a Wednesday, after work, we got in the car, got in my big car, and drove out to Glen Allen. It's about 7 or 8 hour drive out to McCarthy, where we were getting our plane. So we decided to make the drive in two stages, which was a good idea, so that we didn't have to worry or stress too much about getting there on time for the plane. We had dinner on the way out at Zach and Annette Steer's place, Sheep Mountain Lodge. Really good meal. They're doing some great stuff there. And then we continued driving camped in the state recreation area, the Dry Creek State Recreation Area, just north of Glen Allen, which is a campground that's been there forever. I've certainly camped there before. It's the main thing to recommend it is the location near the intersection of the Glen Highway and the Richardson Highway, because it's just a campground, thick trees and sort of mosquito territory, pretty thick bugs. But we were just sleeping there. So next morning we got up, stopped in at the National Park headquarters in Copper Center and borrowed some bear barrels. We had a few of our own, but we borrowed a couple of more bear resistant canisters. Those are loaned out free to the public and just with a credit card deposit. And then continued out the Edgerton Highway and McCarthy Road to park the car by the McCarthy River and leave our stuff that we didn't need and then head across the footbridge to McCarthy. And that was where we kind of spent a little bit of time visiting the town and caught up with the head interpretive ranger of the park to find out a little bit more about where we were going to be going. And so that's going to be our show today. We're on a wonderful trip, and I hope to give you lots of good information about going out to Wrangell St. Elias National Park. It's something I would recommend anybody give a try. So stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Out in the in McCarthy at the McCarthy Museum, which I guess is an old rail depot, and I'm talking with Todd Stebrel, who's the chief of interpretation for Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Thanks for being with us on Outdoor Explorer.
No problem.
So, for those who don't know much about this park, this is the largest national park. I mean, the dimensions of this place are just huge, right?
Yes, we're at 13.2 million acres, which is the largest National Park Service unit in the country, and it's six times the size of Yellowstone, so it's a pretty big place, bigger than Switzerland, so really large wilderness place.
Yeah, and in terms of the wildland, if you look at a map, you go across the border to Canada and you're still in a national park.
Yeah, exactly. It's we are part of a much bigger area that is a World Heritage Site, along with Wrangell St. Elias. There is Kluane National Park, and there's the Tashini-Elisac River Park, provincial parks, and then Glacier Bay, which all those parks together combined to be over 24 million acres of protected land across two countries.
And that's got to be one of the largest
areas of protected land wilderness in the world.
It is. It's actually the second. The largest is in Greenland, but it's but it's a pretty big area.
Yeah. So, and then in terms of topographically, if you look at a map sort of in relief, and, you know, Alaska Range is obviously huge, and all these other mountains are huge, but this is just an area of just almost like a confluence of mountain ranges, of just huge mountains that go on forever.
That's correct. There's actually four different mountain ranges that come together. You have the Chugach Range that, you know, stretches all the way into Anchorage and so forth. And then you have the Wrangell Range, and you have the St. Elias Range. And then to the north of that, you have the Alaska Range that stretches all the way into Denali. So there's four mountain ranges that actually come together right here in the park.
Yeah. So basically for backcountry folks, it's kind of unlimited opportunities. You know, there's still mountains that haven't been climbed yet, probably a lot of them, a lot of rivers to run. And then we're going to get into all that. And that's going to be the main focus of the show today as we take our base camp trip out with Wrangell Mountaineer and do our stuff that I'm doing with my friends. But also, it would be a mistake, I think, not to cover some of the day trip stuff. You know, folks are in Anchorage and even thinking about a long weekend. It's an amazing piece of Alaska out here, and there's history, and there's day hiking, and there's all kinds of stuff to do here. You don't have to go in the backcountry.
That's correct. You know, we're only about a three-hour drive, or a little over three-hour drive, just to get to the Copper Center, which is our main headquarters area, which we have a nice visitor center there, and good place to get oriented to the park, and we have films and exhibits and programs that we do from there. And then from there, you can branch out to either go north or south. We're out here in Kennecott, which is a southern area. It's about another 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on how, you know, well, mostly probably closer to 3 hours of drive.
Depends on how you feel about rough roads.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the McCarthy Road, you know, has had a reputation of being really poor, but the Department of Transportation has really improved the road over recent years. And so it actually isn't a very bad road, but there's a lot of good things.
I would agree with that. You know, I drove it back, I guess, 25 years ago, and it was pretty hair-raising. I mean, it was like big mud holes, and it was really challenging. And you still get to go over that big railroad trestle, which is really exciting. But most of it is, I mean, the gravel part is smooth, 45 miles an hour. I mean, if you've got a good vehicle, and a significant amount of it is paved as well. So it's really not the big challenge. You could easily do it with a passenger car.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The first, you know, 18, 19 miles is practically almost paved. And then that's where you hit the Cuscalana Bridge. It's that one-lane bridge, which is pretty amazing, that you go across the Cuscalana River. And, you know, there's a nice little wayside there that explains that with you. And then you go up a little bit farther to the Gilhena Trestle, which is another place that's really neat. The old trestle's still there from the railroad days. And you know, yeah, it's really an easy road to do with a normal passenger vehicle.
I'm guessing most people come out, take part in the history here, because the historic sites are just incredible. And maybe an overview of, I'm sure you could talk for hours on that subject, but like sort of what the attractions are.
Sure. Once you get out here to the end of the road, you hit a footbridge where you have to get a shuttle to go up to Kennecott or McCarthy. That's where the old mine was from. Was operational from about 1907 to 1938. And many of the buildings are owned by the National Park Service, and we've been in the process of stabilizing them to allow the public to actually go into them. So there's a lot of history to explore, and you can do that on your own, or you can do it with a guide.
Yeah, and it's a real-life ghost town. It was sort of out here in the wilderness, and when the railroad shut down, they pulled out the tracks. It just sat here in a time capsule. So I don't know, it's been a few years since I saw the buildings, but I remember that, like, there are papers in cubbies, and there are like bottles of stuff, and it's really, there's an ore in the machinery. So it was really kind of like time stopped in a way.
Yeah, it did. You know, it's gotten a little bit different from that. I mean, back in, say, the 70s and 80s, it was like that, but it's, you know, got a little bit more civilized, I guess, if you will. you know, there are some private businesses that operate up actually in Kennecott today. You know, there's a lodge up there that you can stay in, and some guiding services and so forth up there. But for the most part, you know, the buildings that are still there, we've restored or are stabilized. But some of the buildings also have just kind of collapsed over the years, too, and just are in ruins. So some of them are actually completely gone. We had a major flood several years ago that kind of took out some of the buildings as well.
Well, it's been 100 years since that stuff was built. Yeah. So, and there's some good day hiking around here up towards the glacier and up towards the mountains. But then our main focus on the show is going to be the backcountry. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one difference that's really notable about this national park compared to, say, Denali is that there's not a ton of regulations and rules about where you can go. You're pretty free, but you need to be pretty self-reliant.
That's correct. You know, there are some trails, but for the most part, people come out here just to explore. And it is really wild country, and we do allow or have people get bear-resistant food canisters, which is kind of not necessarily a requirement, but it's really the best thing to do to help store your food, because we do have lots of wild bears out here, and certainly we don't want those encounters with humans at all and get them used to humans. So, but like down home,
there's precious few trees to hang your stuff on. So you need one of these bear-proof containers. And how can folks obtain those? They don't have to pay for them, right?
That's correct. We can get them at our visitor center up there in Kennecott. Even some of the guide services down here, like Ringo Mountain Air, will also supply those to parties that fly out in the backcountry as well. So, we really emphasize leave no trace. There's no designated campsites. I mean, it's just, go out there and explore and enjoy the wilderness.
Yeah. So we're going to be flying out with Wrangell Mountain Air, and we'll be talking with them. And St. Elias Alpine Guides are two outfits where if you pay a little bit, you can get some guidance and get put somewhere and, like, get help in what you're going to do. If folks don't want to spend the money to be guided, where can they get the information they need to set up a backcountry trip?
Sure. Right at our visitor center up in Kennecott, we can certainly guide people to places where they want to go, like Donahoe Basin, for instance. You go across the Root Glacier, and then you get over to this little basin area. It's a great experience. You can be looking back on Kennecott, basically, and it's something that where you don't have to pay any money to fly you out, but it's still a great experience, a wilderness experience, and you're probably going to encounter bears over there, too.
Uh-huh. Do you guys, I kind of remember you guys used to publish some route descriptions or some printed materials, probably maybe on your website, about sort of how you could access the park from different points of view?
Yeah, we do. We have different handouts, if you will, and we can get those at the visitor center too, up there in Kennecott. It just depends on where you want to go and what you want to do. I mean, there's two trails that lead you up to the mines themselves. The mines are over 3,000 feet above where the town sat, so it's quite a haul to get up there, but it's some fantastic views when you get up there. You get above treeline.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that much out here that doesn't take a little bit of work. Even the mine tour, you've got to climb a lot of steps and stuff.
That's correct, yeah. The building itself, the old concentration mill is still intact, and St. Elias Alpine Guides does the guiding through that facility, but it does quite a long ways up to the top, and then you work your way down through the building itself and quite a bit, few steps and so forth to walk through.
Yeah, and I guess that's a two-hour tour and costs like $27. And, I mean, just from my experience, very well worth it. The amount of history you pick up in that 2 hours is extraordinary. And we'll be talking to those folks about some of their other offerings and stuff. How about getting around when you're here? Because Kennecott and McCarthy, I guess as I understand it, Kennecott was sort of the fancier town, and McCarthy was sort of the Wild West sort of town. They're not exact. They're separated by about 5 miles or so.
Yeah, that's correct. So there's a shuttle service that operates from through Wrangell Mountain Air that will pick you up at the bridge where you would park your vehicle, and from there they'll shuttle you over here to McCarthy first, and then on up to Kennecott, because it's about a 5 mile distance between the two. And it's all uphill, so you can walk it if you want, but it is all uphill. So, and that runs almost every half an hour during the middle of summer. So it's fairly frequently to get anywhere around out here.
So, am I right about the history of that? That sort of the middle class area, the corporate area, was Kennecott with all those nice red buildings with the white trim, and then the rocking rolling town was down here, McCarthy, and so different types of people and stuff happening. What was that all about?
Sure. The Kennecott was a company town, so they had strict rules about everything. No alcohol, no single women, all these different types of things. So, of course, you have a bunch of miners that are young men and lots of free time. And so in order to enjoy themselves, if you will, they came down here to McCarthy, which kind of sprung up as an alternative place to come and, maybe have some adult beverages and other types of recreational activities. And so, McCarthy was definitely the alternative place to go to recreate versus up there in Kennecott, which was very much regulated and pretty strict.
Yeah. So we're focusing mostly on this kind of central area of the park and flying out from here, but there's also the Nevesna Road up in the north end, and then there's also sort of the outer coast, which is maybe getting more attention. I get the feeling more people are coming out to some of these places than used to be in the past. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what folks can expect in those areas?
Sure. The north end of the park, the Nevesna area, is another totally different landscape, really, if you will, than out here in Kennecott McCarthy. And another a great road to drive, a little bit not as easy to drive as the McCarthy Road, but it's still passable by to a passenger vehicle. We have a campground up there, a designated campground. You can actually camp on the road. And at the very end of the road, there's several trails too, I should say, that are actually designated trails that you can actually hike on. And so it's more of that traditional national park experience, I guess, not much development at all, and more just, you know, designated trails where you can hike and some really beautiful country out there too.
Good wildlife viewing?
Yes, definitely wildlife viewing, moose and bears. It's a little bit more open on that road where you can actually see the mountains, where on the McCarthy Road, you're kind of, you know, you're tucked in the trees a lot. You don't really get those nice open views that you'll have up on the north end of the road.
Yeah, and I mean, if people are thinking about planning a trip, it's not like some places where you say, hey, let's go to McCarthy and go to Nevesna Road. No, you got to choose one or the other because the distances here are enormous. I mean, it just blows your mind once you realize how far away everything is. Yeah. So what about the South Coast?
Sure. I was just actually down there last week, and that's the down near Yakutat, which has direct airline service right out of Anchorage. That's how you get there. Or you can also take the ferry across there, too. And that's where the mountain St. Elias is actually located. It's actually down there. And again, big glaciers down there. We have a huge glacier called the Hubbard Glacier, which is the largest tidewater glacier in the world. It's over 7 miles across at the face. And the cruise ships go in there all the time, but you can take a charter boat to go up there and actually see it. And it's just an amazing thing to watch because it calves pretty frequently in the summertime.
Yeah. All right. So, just a fantastic place to come visit, and people really, and you know, more people should come out and spend the time to be here because it really is extraordinary. Well, I want to thank you very much, Todd Stebrel. He's the director, the chief interpretive ranger here at Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Thanks for being with us on Outdoor Explorer.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
I'm out camping in the park now. This is Charles Wolforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. We flew out of McCarthy. It was sunny and warm, and our flight left there in the early evening, about 5 o'clock, and had a gorgeous flight with Wrangell Mountain Air. You know, got all of our stuff in the plane. We'd been told to hold it to 60 pounds. We were probably per person in terms of our gear. We're pretty close to that. Our party of four all fit in a De Havilland Beaver, which is beautiful old rotary engine plane, sort of the pack horse of the backcountry, big balloon tire so it can land on sand, gravel bars and anywhere else, and had a really nice flight out. Just the scenery in the park is unbelievable, and the real highlight, about a 40-minute flight to the east of McCarthy to get really deep into the park, and landed on a strip in near Skull Eye Pass, or in Skull Eye Pass, and got our stuff out and had the plane leave, and there we were. So first miscalculation of the trip. We planned a base camp trip, and when we got together for dinner, we planned out a lot of fancy meals with food that is relatively heavy and that you wouldn't normally take on a backpacking trip, because we were figuring, well, base camp, we're just going to be camping in one place. We won't have to move it around that much. So, you know, we've got fresh eggs, we've got cream, we've got you know, all kinds of delicious food. You know, it brought a bunch of smoked salmon along. But as it turns out, our friends in McCarthy suggested we hike to a campsite that was several miles from the landing strip, which, you know, is very, very doable, not too hard. But we were getting started in the evening, and we had these very heavy loads because we'd packed all this stuff for a base camp experience, and you know, cross country hiking without trails is never all that easy. So we ended up feeling pretty wiped out by the time we stopped, and we didn't go as far or as high as had been suggested by our friends. We made it several miles into the pass towards Russell Glacier, and found a really nice campsite up on the side of sort of a mountainside where there's a little bit of a buttress with a flat area. So it's a small and very fairly steep campsite, but it worked for us. We were pretty wiped out. As we chalked it up to mistake number one. If you're going to do a base camp and pack heavy, you have to camp pretty close to the airstrip, which might not be that great because there could be other people camped there. So more of a backpacking mode is probably recommended, even if you're doing a base camp experience. Anyway, we got our stuff together, got camped out, and had a good meal, and everybody's having a real good time. It was quite hot and sweaty that first day, but then the next morning it was raining, and we got some wind and colder weather, but we got up and had breakfast and had some really nice day hiking. So anyway, along the way out here, I stopped off to talk with some friends at St. Elias Alpine Guides. It's a company that's been around for a long time. Bob Jacobs, who was a pretty famous guide on McKinley, started the guide service out here because he got kind of tired of the crowds in Denali and the number of people climbing McKinley. He sold it a number of years ago to Wayne and Gaia Mars, who are still running it. Gaia was off floating the Copper River, and Wayne was off getting supplies in Anchorage. So, but they hooked me up with one of their guides at their headquarters in McCarthy to talk about different options for folks who want to take trips, and had a really good conversation. So I'd like to introduce you to the guy that we met there.
We're at St. Elias Alpine Guides in McCarthy, and in this amazing powerhouse building, which was in use way back there in the copper mining times, and a big post and beam building with huge iron boiler in it, and climbing ropes and water bottles and all kinds of crazy stuff hanging all over the place, because this is a guide service that provides backcountry trips in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. And I'm sitting with Ethan Moorhead, who's one of the guides who leads these trips, and we're in the equipment room, which is kind of like a mountaineering museum, actually looking around here, seeing all this stuff and wondering about, like, well, how many trips has this stuff been on? Yeah. So, so this is kind of a famous company that Bob Jacobs had, and now Wayne and Gaia Mars own the company. And you guys, really, you know, your catalog of trips is pretty amazing. I mean, you take some people on some very challenging mountaineering trips as well as easier sort of just day hiking trips.
Yeah, we do. We kind of run the full gambit, anything from day hikes out on the Root Glacier here in Kennecott to just last week we notched up two more first descents on some of the more alpine mountains in the area. And I just got back from a 5-day backpacking trip, so kind of run all sorts of different skill levels and get to see everything from the mountains to the tundra rivers.
Yeah, I wonder how many companies are capable of having, like, first descents in their catalog. Like, yeah, you want to climb a mountain that's never been climbed before? We'll take you up, you know? I suppose you probably want people to have a bit of a mountaineering experience before you do one of those.
Yeah, and there's a screening process for clients. You know, on the day hikes, there's not much of a screening process. We usually say if you can do a 5-mile hike, you can do the Root Glacier Trail. But on the everything from backpacking to the first descents trips, you go through more and more rigorous kind of background screening on trips you've done in the past. And so we're lucky to have people out that come with us of kind of all skill levels, from never having backpacked before to guys who are practically full-on mountaineers in their own right and just like to come out to our playground here.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk just about why this is such a great place. So obviously it's incredibly huge, incredibly remote, lots of big mountains. I mean, what do you like about it? What brings you here or makes you really want to be a guide in this area?
Well, I think the two big things for me are the big mountains. That's why a lot of the guides who work here and a lot of people who come out here are here. Is you've got really big, remote mountains, just glaciated peaks, and enough of them. When you get down to the Cascades in California, there's all sorts of small peaks you can hit, and larger ones, Rainier and that kind of thing. But out here, we're just lousy with climbing potential, and so most of our guides are climbers in some way or another. And another thing that I think draws people out here as guides is it's a good place to either kind of learn the craft of guiding or practice this in a very highly specialized area. A lot of places in the lower 48, you can say you're a wilderness guide, but you're never more than 5 miles from a paved road, and you can get cell service, and there's all sorts of kind of easy way out of a bad situation. And out here, to be a wilderness guide, you got to really be on top of your stuff. So it's a great place to learn those specific skill sets and practice being a real wilderness guide.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that many places left in the world where there's really no communication, and really wild places, and not only no communication, but you're very unlikely to even run into people out there, right? I mean, I suppose in some of the more popular places you'll see other folks, but I imagine some of the places you go, you'll do a long trip and not see anyone.
Absolutely. On a lot of our multi-day backpacking trips, the people you're with and the guides you're with are the only humans you're going to see once the plane drops you off until he picks you up. So you get this really unique experience of not running into another person. And on some of the mountaineering trips, the one that just went out, they landed on a strip, if you can even call it a landing strip at that point, just a snow-covered glacier. And the pilot said nobody had ever landed on that particular strip before. So you get the unique experience of not only not seeing anybody, but being somewhere nobody else has probably ever been.
Yeah, a planet with 6 billion people, that's a very finite resource, not too much of it left, you know. And it feels pretty special to be out here. Even, you know, it's a lot more people here than there were, say, 20 years ago, but it's still really, you know, really out here and really feels like authentically Alaska.
Yeah, I think so. That's another thing that I really like about it out here, and I think that draws people both to living out here, climbing out here, guiding out here, is somewhere like a Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Yet 10 million people a year are going to go through there. And through Kennecott and McCarthy, you're looking at more like orders of magnitude lower than that. Just a few thousand people are going to go through here. And when you get to the backcountry, on any given year, you might, you know, easily less than 1,000 people. You're going to be one of the very elite out there hiking around in that area.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't have to do a super tough backcountry trip. I come out here, and I think most people come out just go to Kennecott and see the historic sites and do some day hiking in your Root Glacier Trail. And maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because that is a really, really cool trip that you can even just do as a weekend out of Anchorage, maybe a long weekend, drive out on Friday and drive back on Sunday. It'd be minimal, I think, with the amount of drive, but still it would be pretty fun. You guys do the mill tour. Give us a sort of summary of what that is. And it's like $27 and a couple of times a day.
Yeah. So it's $27.50 and we're doing it three times a day, 9:30, 1:30 and 3:30. And we get to go through the whole Kennecott town, which that's another thing that makes Wrangell St. Elias, I think, kind of especially unique, is not only do we have this incredibly large wilderness area, but we have a World Heritage site in the Kennecott Mines. So we go through some of the buildings that have been kind of reconstructed and done up to look the way they would have 100 years ago. And then we go through some of the buildings that have been left, you know, to the elements and look like they're 100-year-old actual ghost town buildings. And it's a lot of talking about the history, the people who founded the area and the people who kind of built this company and what life was like for them in this sort of Wild West copper town.
Yeah. So you guys are the concessionaire for that. So I'm sure there's sort of a quality level you have to maintain in terms of the information that you provide due to the Park Service monitoring what you're up to.
Absolutely. And that's getting the concession gets harder and harder every year. But we're lucky in that a lot of our guides, the more you come back, the more they get kind of a personal interest in the area. So some of the information we have on the tour is relatively exclusive to us. We've got really extensive training on it. And the more you do it, the more you have fun with it. So, you know, after years of coming back, I'm reading books on my own time about it, getting more and more kind of small anecdotes. And it definitely doesn't hurt that we've been doing these tours since before it was even a national park. So we've got a long history internally in the company of being out here and making these tours fun for people.
Yeah. So the Root Glacier outing is an opportunity for people who've never been on a glacier to walk on a glacier safely with a guide. And it's you don't have to be super fit to do it. I mean, you could do it the same day as you do the mill tour.
Yeah, correct. It's relatively close to, I would say, about a 5-mile, pretty flat hike. The more fit you are, the more parts of the glacier you get to see. But the first part of the hike is just a smooth dirt trail out, and then we put on crampons and get to walk around, see some of the glacial features. We're really lucky in that the Root Glacier is very safe where we are on it. So what we like to tell people is there are definitely objective hazards out there, but we're going to see them coming. So with a guide, you know, you're able to pretty easily work around all the more dangerous stuff and get to see it from an awesome view, see some of the parts of the glacier that average person won't get to see.
Do you teach people mountaineering skills who might want to go on some of the more challenging trips, or do you sort of like to screen them to make sure they have the skills when they sign up?
It would depend on the trip. We actually do lead mountaineering training trips. So we usually have at least one of those go out a year where we take people who maybe they've rock climbed before, maybe they've skied in the backcountry before, but they'd like to learn the rope work, the ice axe work, kind of the technical side to mountaineering. And so we're lucky to get to teach people those skills in a place that it's safe to learn them and get to practice them.
Yeah, and then some of the climbs you do are really technical. Technical climbs, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen because you're pioneering routes that nobody's done before.
Yeah, and that's what makes the first descents especially exciting. We do lead some of the more difficult mountains in the area. We did a Blackburn ascent last year, 16,390 feet. That's a beautiful mountain we get to look at every day. And so there are established routes on some of the bigger peaks there that may or may not be more or less technical. But then on the first descents trips, you're with a guide who knows their guiding and mountaineering craft super well, and you guys just kind of work together to find a way up that mountain that no one's ever been.
Yeah. So we're headed out to Scolai Pass, and our plane is leaving in like a couple hours here. I'm really excited about going. And it sounds like you spent some time in that area.
Yeah, I've done a few trips out there over the years. Absolutely beautiful area. I would say one of my favorite views on Earth.
All right, I can't wait to see it. So what are your we're going to be sort of base camping, and we're going to be dropped off by Wrangell Mountain Air, and then we'll be looking for a base camp. And any recommendations about where we should camp and stuff you recommend in that area?
Sure. You're going to be within a pretty short hike of the Russell Glacier. It's a gigantic glacier coming down from some of the bigger mountains in the area, and it feeds the White River, I believe, that goes into Canada. So really awesome glacial views out there, and you're also pretty equal distance away from Chittistone Pass and Scolai Pass. So you're very near the Chittistone Goat Trail, which is a historic trail that they use to get to the gold fields in Canada. And so really beautiful hiking, kind of an interesting human history out that way that you'll get to see the tundra and the glacier and footprints of prospectors from 100 years ago.
Uh-huh. So do you guys do that as sort of a base camping thing, or do you do more backcountry sort of point to point, or what do you primarily do with people who are not into technical climbing?
We'll do it as both. I'm heading out in a week myself to do a base camp in the area, so we'll just stay probably pretty close to the strip and do some nice side hikes for people who are less familiar with backpacking. But we also lead a couple backpacking trips on the Chittistone Goat Trail itself, so it's not necessarily technical mountaineering, but it is going to be a little bit more rigorous backpacking. And there are some peaks. If you're into climbing, the Frederica Glacier in the area has some peaks. Definitely get your alpine fun in.
Uh-huh. So any climbs that you do out there that are non-technical and don't require ropes?
I'd have to think about that. Most of the climbing we do tends to be more technical, but that said, pretty much anywhere you are, you'll be able to find one of the smaller peaks in the area that you can kind of scramble up. So we're lucky in our valley to have a Donahoe, which is one of our favorite peaks that you don't need a rope, just a solid guide and nice hands and feet to get to the top of. But we generally do those as part of the backpacking trip. So maybe as one of the side hikes, we'll climb up a smaller, possibly unnamed peak without any technical stuff.
So what does it cost for someone who wants to join one of these trips, just sort of a ballpark in terms of, you know, a backpacking trip, and then maybe if somebody wanted to join a trip that was more technical?
It's going to depend a lot on where you go. So we're very lucky to have Wrangell Mountain Air in the area, and they can fly us into some of these more remote parts of the park. So if you're getting one flight or maybe two flights with them, it's going to change the cost of the trips. But we've got backcountry trips for anywhere from close to probably $800 for some of the shorter, closer ones to, I expect you could get up to $8,000 for some of these big mountaineering trips if you're looking for something way out and way crazy.
Yeah. And you guys do float trips as well, right?
Absolutely. We've got the Copper River fed by a glacier very near us, so we'll do everything from a nice float along the local rivers for a day to 14-plus days floating all the way from the source of the Copper River to the sea at Cordova.
So what do you find, like, in terms of how many folks are coming out here, and where are they coming from? Are people from Alaska? Or is it mostly people from, like, Europe and outside Alaska that are coming? I'm just curious because it's, I actually don't have a good sense of that.
Yeah, we get them from all over the place. We do get a pretty large European group, which is fun, just lots of Germans and Swiss. But you'd be surprised how many people come here from Alaska. I can't count how many times I've had somebody come from Palmer or Wasilla and say, you know, I've lived in Alaska my whole life and I've never come out here. I can't believe I've been missing this for 40 plus years. So it's exciting to see. You know, you don't have to be from Texas like me to be impressed by these mountains. People who grew up in the area are still totally awed by the Wrangell-St. Elias area.
Yeah. So tell me about yourself. How did you get into this? How did you become a guide?
I was a Boy Scout. I am an Eagle Scout. And I started by guiding with the Scouts down in New Mexico, Philmont Scout Ranch. And I'm also a climber, and I wanted to see bigger mountains. So one of the things that drew me to this company in the area was I knew how to guide backpacking trips, and I wanted to be a mountaineering guide. And so I picked a company that could do both. And I think that's one of the nice things about this company is we've got professional rafters, professional backpackers, professional mountaineers all sharing one roof, and we all kind of learn from each other. I taught some of our mountaineering guides basic stove maintenance last night, and they teach me how to pull myself out of a crevasse on a big snowy peak.
Uh-huh. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're recording in McCarthy, the show today is about Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, and we're going to be out in the backcountry and talking with Ethan Moorhead, who is with St. Elias Alpine Guides, and just learning about what they do, the trips they take to the backcountry and the places you can go and stuff. So, Ethan, give me some examples of some favorite places and the sort of variety of places somebody could go if they want to go to the backcountry and to see the park or set up their own trip.
Sure. I would say one of the guide favorites out here as far as backpacking goes is a trip we call Lackinac, and that's somewhere around a week of backpacking starting here in Kennecott and McCarthy, and you'll hike out across a couple of the local glaciers, and then you enter the Hidden Creek Valley heading towards Lackinac Pass and the Lackinac Glacier, and it very quickly becomes just very lush green hills and verdant kind of meadows, just idyllic hiking. We actually call it the Journey to Oz, because as you come up into the pass, it's just the brightest green, out-of-this-world fantasy meadows, just sheep on all sides and beautiful mountains and streams. And so for people looking for some of the more kind of green cush hiking, I would say that's the best backpacking around.
Yeah, and for people who are not picturing this, it's pretty much everything is above treeline out there. There's not pretty much all alpine tundra and rock.
Absolutely, yeah. You kind of have to pick and choose if you want some of the more green tundra hiking or some very craggy dirt rock trails.
Yeah. All right, give me another choice.
I would say another big favorite is going to be the Chittistone Goat Trail, and you'll start some places, for example, Scoli is very green, but along the trail itself, you're looking at very crazy geology. So a lot rockier hiking and just catastrophically beautiful views of some of the mountains out here, passing by some of the biggest peaks on the continent and getting to do a little bit, I would say, harder backpacking. And just a total change of scenery. You wouldn't believe it's the same park.
Huh. So would you get flown in and then picked up by an airplane at the other end, or would you be able to hike back to a road, or how would that work?
You would be flown in for the goat trail. You're flown into both ends of the trip.
Okay. Any other ideas you'd like to share?
Sure. One of my favorite landing strips is actually the closest one to Kennecott. It's called the Foss. And generally, we kind of name our trips by what landing strips we use. So our trips to the Foss are usually the least expensive because it's very close in. You can hike either to the landing strip or from the landing strip, so it's only one bush plane flight. And you end up, depending on the hike you choose, right in the face of Mount Blackburn, which kind of is the father of the Kennecott Glacier. And it's just out of this world beautiful. You can get very easy access to some nice green areas and creeks. You can go play on the Kennecott Glacier, which is 27 miles long, and get amazing views with pretty minimal effort.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks for giving us some of that stuff. That's like inspiring and fun. So I want to talk a little bit about safety and preparation. And I talked a little bit about with the Park Service interpreter about the bear-proof containers. Do you run into a lot of bears on your trips? Have you run into trouble with bears? Do you guys carry bear spray or guns?
Yeah, I've run into bears on most of my backcountry trips, I'd say, although it depends very much on the area you're going to and the time of year. But we will carry, every guide will have a can of bear spray, and also we carry the screamer guns, which shoot basically model rocket engines at the bears, making a loud noise. But as many times as I've run into bears, I've never had to use either of those. We have had problem bears in certain areas of the parks ever, but generally speaking, I feel really kind of lucky to get to see a bear, and more often than not, they look up at you and then turn and run away as fast as they can.
Yeah, they take off. So you use those bear-proof containers for storing your food, and what other kinds of stuff do you guys do for bear avoidance?
Well, in any bear country, whether it's in Alaska or in the lower 48, you want to kind of disperse where the smellable things are. So we use the bear-proof containers, but then we always store that away from our cooking area, and both of those are noticeably away from our camping area. So we don't have one of these compact campsites like you would car camping or at an area without bears. Things are a little bit more spread out just so that if there is a bear in the area, they're less likely to smell our stuff, and if they do smell it, they're less likely to come anywhere near our tents.
Okay. Do you carry any kind of communication when you're on your trips? A sat phone, or what sort of thing of that kind do you use?
Yeah, generally speaking, we'll have sat phones. Some of the mountaineering trips were lucky enough to use aircraft radio, which can be a little bit more immediate and at least two-way communication a little easier. And if we're in a close enough vicinity of Kennecott and McCarthy, cell phones do work. So on some of the shorter trips, we've got cell phones that we're able to use.
Okay. So what other what do you look for in clients when you're sizing them up to figure out what they're going to be capable of? I'm curious about that because I think a lot of times people are thinking, well, I'd like to do something a little bit more challenging. Am I ready for it? Think about, like, what are their own capabilities? What kind of skills do you look for, or physical attributes do you look for in sort of deciding whether somebody's ready for a more challenging trip?
Well, I'd have to say, as a guide, it's not usually up to me. It starts more with our manager, and she goes through a kind of an extensive process. Most of the time, what we get are people who say, I'd like to come and do a trip in the area, but I don't know what I'm ready for. And so she's really good at kind of sussing out people's abilities and helping them choose a trip that they will be capable for. As a guide, the biggest thing I look for is a good attitude, because no matter how fit you are, Alaska will beat you up. The glaciers are tough. Moraine is tough. You know, no matter where you're hiking. The weather, absolutely. The mosquitoes. So the best thing I can hear is just somebody who is there ready to say, okay, this sucks, but I can handle it. I can suck it up.
Uh-huh. And the worst thing you could hear is that first complaint, and then you're thinking, oh, no.
Yeah, what's really refreshing is when people accept that a bad spell of weather or a tough hike isn't the guide's fault. And that's a very nice, refreshing thing when somebody says, ah, that was a tough day. Thank you for making it a little less tough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably the number one skill for a guide, too, is attitude and getting along with a variety of people and keeping things up, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say a big thing we look for at both this company and other guiding companies I've been to is it's more than being a strong backpacker or a strong climber and learning how to guide. It's about being a guide and knowing how to apply that to a different area. It's a lot easier to kind of learn an area than learn the people skills and how to take care of somebody who's having a really rough 12-hour day on a glacier.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for being with us and sharing all this information. Ethan Moorhead with St. Elias Alpine Guides, and we're really looking forward to I think we can go over the map a little bit before we leave and get some more of your tips about the spot where we're going.
Absolutely. You're very welcome.
All right. Thanks for being with us. Trip is almost over. It's Sunday, and we've got one more day of hiking, and then we'll be flying out again on Monday. And it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Walforth. I'm in Wrangell St. Elias National Park near in Scolai Pass. We had some just amazingly spectacular hiking while we were out here. We hiked up to Chittisone Pass. There's a trail that leads up there. A sort of, you know, a traditional trail that was used by prospectors and has been, I guess,
kept a trail over the years just by the fact that, you know, a limited number of people use it. But we hiked up pretty good, maybe 1,500 foot elevation gain from where we're camping. A little bit of scrambling, but not too bad. And all this is gorgeous country above treeline where you can see forever, and you can plan your routes super easily and just lovely. And, you know, rainy and a bit windy and cool, but still had some great views. And we hiked up into the pass and saw these amazing glaciers and just huge vistas that are kind of boggle the mind. You know, once you get out here and see how big everything is and how the forces of nature are still enacting their will on the ground and creating these mountains, and you can see how all of that's happening. You can see the layers of rock. In some ways, it looks a lot like the Southwest because you've got a lot of sedimentary rock forming these horizontal layers and sort of mesa-shaped mountains. We're right near Castle Mountain, which is a really extraordinary mountain of these layers coming up to a peak and lots of vertical spires. And there's lots of soft, crumbly rock here with lots of unusual shapes, spires and rivers, and lots of also, I think because of the nature of the geology, a lot of flat benches where you can hike a long way over tundra that is, on the most part, is dry. And, of course, plenty of water coming down from the snow and glaciers. Most of the snow is gone. We're hiking at the end of June, and the year is pretty advanced because of the lack of snow we had this year. And so we're lucky enough to be here at the absolute peak of wildflowers. And these tundra benches are just carpeted with brilliant, brilliant colors. And so it's just been a spectacular couple of days. Could have wished for better weather. You know, we've been wet quite a bit, but everybody's in really good spirits. We're having great meals. Really nice to go camping with a group of people who have lived a little bit of life, and everybody just jumps in to do their job and do their part, and there's no conflict or anybody certainly shirking or anything. Everybody's trying to outdo each other to be the better camper and the better cook. So that makes it a lot of fun. And in the evening, just talking about politics or friends, telling stories, playing cards. We were playing hearts in the tent, and that's all been really fun. So it's been a fantastic trip. I would certainly recommend anybody who has got a little bit of backpacking experience, or even if you've got a friend who does, who can take you along, to come out here and enjoy this country where you're so far away from limits and so far away from other people and really can experience the real Alaska on your own. So we're going to be headed back to McCarthy tomorrow. Today we're breaking camp, hiking back towards the landing strip. We'll camp tonight at the landing strip here, waiting for the plane to come in on Monday morning, and then Monday we'll be going back into town. I plan to talk to some of the folks from Wrangell Mountain Air about their business and about how they help people get out here, and then we'll be driving from McCarthy all the way back to Anchorage, and then I'll be back at work on Tuesday. So our time is over out in Scolai Pass, and the plane from Wrangell Mountain Air, the Beaver again, is circling in to pick us up, and we're all packed up, and he's pretty close to being on time, and it's a really nice, really nice day for our flight.
Fire extinguisher mounted on the floor there in front of the pilot seat. Might have my pack over the top of it. And then the ELT is activated by a little red switch in front of the co-pilot up there. It says air tech ELT. There.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Got it. Okay.
I should ask about the when I get back to the office, ask about it.
About what?
With bear spray tape.
Are we doing a Karita?
No, I think it's okay.
There's probably a certain amount that you can disrupt and it's still not a problem.
Sounds of flight.
Turn it on.
Thank you. Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. So I'm back in McCarthy. We've had this amazingly beautiful flight with Wrangell Mountain Air coming back from Scolai Pass. And I just feel like the dream is ending because we had such a gorgeous, wonderful time. And Kelly Bay was flying us, who is one of the owners of Wrangell Mountain Air, and I'm with the other, Natalie Bay. And you guys have been doing this for quite a while.
Yeah, since the 80s, bringing out people to go out into the backcountry.
So I'm imagining that in the summertime you don't have a lot of days off, because I'm seeing this, your office is like this beehive of activity of people coming and going, and you're also running the van back and forth and all that.
The season for the backcountry is pretty short, you know, because we have to wait for the snow to leave the upper elevations, and that's where everybody wants to go. So it's a pretty short backpacking season. So people want to go. We want to be able to take them.
And you kind of try to schedule it so you're dropping somebody off and you're picking somebody up and you're sort of keeping the whole thing rolling and flight seeing and everything else. It just looks to me like your mind must be a computer with all these different things going different directions.
Well, I guess with the backcountry, it would be nice if there were people both ways, but often there are not. The main thing we try to do is spread people out so there's not too many people in the one place or doing the same route.
So one of the things that you have, it seems to be a really good website where people can sort of find out what they want to do. And I'm sure you probably spend a lot of time on the phone helping people figure out what they want to do as well. Is that sort of a big part of the business, is like getting people off the ground?
Right. The website is great. We used to spend lots of time on the phone and writing letters, but the website helps with basic information, how much it's going to cost, where you can go, or rather where we can land, not necessarily where you can go. And so people can get an idea from the website before they call or email, which is usually the case these days. And then we can start narrowing down what trip is going to be good for them.
What do you do to, in terms of screening people so that you know that you're not just dropping somebody out there who's completely unable to deal with the backcountry? Because, I mean, obviously you're not really responsible for them. I saw the release, you know. It's a very complete release. But on the other hand, it would be a lot of trouble for you if you're taking people out or just over their heads, right?
Right. And as an air taxi, we're not really – that's not our business. And Wrangell St. Elias being, you know, a wilderness park, generally speaking, the people that want to come to a place like this where there are no trails for them to follow are somewhat prepared. And the Park Service also tries to let them know what they're getting into. An acknowledgement of risk form is one way to let them know what they're getting into. But yes, you get a big range of people that want to do this. People from Alaska generally know what to expect. But from outside Alaska, that's one of the first questions you ask them is, have you ever hiked in Alaska before? And then you go from there. And if they say, but I can do 25 miles in a day, then your next statement might be, yes, but it usually takes a little longer here.
How many spots do you have that you guide people, say, hey, this is a good spot for backpacking or for, you know, base camp, like what we're doing? Do you have, like, designated areas where you think about, oh, this, we want to put people in these areas? And then do you sort of, like, ration it out or and say, well, there's already a bunch of people there. Why don't you try this spot?
We do. We try to spread people out. The place where you went to, Scolai, the hikes that lead out of Scolai, a lot of people have heard about them now because with the internet and everything, people put their trips up online. And so a lot of people have heard about these destinations and they think, I have to go there. Well, we don't want to see too many people in one area. And so we will try and discourage them from going to that area if there's already a number of groups doing it.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of our miscalculation, which is pretty minor, is that we're thinking base camp, like we're going to get out of the plane and set up our base camp. But we ended up hiking several miles, and so we're carrying all this stuff that you would not normally bring along. But because we didn't want to sort of just be, you know, we wanted to be somewhere that was nearer to the pass and that we could sort of
sort of do more hikes from there. So that was sort of the one thing we did wrong. Although we ate like kings, we brought along all kinds of, you know, fresh eggs and fresh vegetables, and so that was really fun. So what are some other spots that you that are good for the sort of the base camp type trip? To name a couple of them.
I think that the term base camp for us means we're going to drop you off and pick you up at the same place. What you do in the meantime is up to you. We like it if people don't camp right by the airstrip, just because there are going to be other people coming and going, and it's just better if you spread out and be a little bit further away. But base camp locations, anywhere we go in this place, is going to be an excellent place to base camp. How many miles you can hike from that place, that will vary, and it'll vary with your own abilities, whether you brought crampons, whether you want to hike on the ice, whether you brought a pack raft and you can cross the streams. That varies. Scenery wise anywhere we take you, it's going to be beautiful. And that's why we end up telling people that it can't decide where they're going to go. Wherever you go, it's going to be great.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, the scenery we saw was just mind-boggling. I have to say that having been all over Alaska and been to pretty much all the national parks around the country, some of the scenery we saw was, like, just jaw-dropping. I mean, some of the most extraordinary places I've ever seen. Just fabulous. Yeah. So what are the – I mean, you've seen an awful lot of people coming through here, and I'm sure you've seen people who had – bad trips as well as good trips. And I'm just wondering what kind of advice you feel is like the most important advice for Kelly just drove up on a four-wheeler, so I guess he got done with his flight. I mean, what's some of the most important advice for planning a trip to make sure you have a good trip?
Wow. Do a little research about other people that have done the trip, or, you know, read what you can. There's usually quite a bit out there. The most important thing, yeah, I'm not sure. Leave plenty of time. Don't try and do it too quickly.
Yeah, it's really unpredictable how long it's going to take you to go from place to place. You can't just tell by looking at a topo map.
No, and then weather comes in. You know, if you're doing a point to point, you can try following your GPS, but what you're really doing is route finding. And if you can't see, then you can't pick the best route, and it's going to take you longer. So sometimes you just have to stay put for a little bit and wait for the weather to get better.
Mm-hmm. Also, the plane might not come when you expect it to just because of weather. And I'm sure probably within a couple of days you usually get everybody, but sometimes you must have that problem.
It's pretty rare not to get everybody within 24 hours, but we have a couple of locations that when the weather's bad, they just hold the weather, and it'll be a few days before we can pick them up. Just a couple of places that are notorious for late pickups.
All right. Well, I want to thank you. We had a great flight, and I thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk to us. I'm Natalie Bay with Wrangell Mountaineer. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So our trip is over. We've driven all the way back to Anchorage. Took us about 7.5-8 hours to get back to town. And now we're dropping friends off along the way, unloading gear and sorting everything out. We've got a lot of laundry to do and food to put away and garbage to take care of, and desperately ready for showers. But, you know, it was a fantastic trip. I think everybody had a great time. We saw some unbelievable territory, and so glad that we did it. And it's just a really good way to enjoy the summer, is to get out to Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Get out there and do it. Enjoy the national parks. So anyway, that's it for this week's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. She's responsible for putting all the sound together. And Grace Bogine is our production assistant. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.